The date was November 21st in 2021. The location was Waukesha, Wisconsin. Darryl Brooks drove into a holiday parade, killed at least six, and over 60 were injured. Here you see a shot from video of the vehicle just before it began to impact people in the parade and also bystanders. The surprising thing about this is that Brooks was out on a $1,000 bail for a felony of punching and trying to run over a woman. $1,000 bail. Some of the injuries were to the Milwaukee dancing grannies, for example. Quite a few, both adults and children, were injured or killed in that thing. The interesting thing about this tragedy is the rap sheet of this person who was let out on $1,000 bail. You know, just a few of the highlights. You can, may not be able to quite read all that, but you can see it's a long rap sheet. 1999, for example, there was aggravated battery and concealed weapon. 2005, resisting arrest. 2010, strangulation and suffocation and domestic abuse. 2012, bail jumping. And in 2021, domestic battery. And then, of course, now, finally they figured, well, maybe we should up the bail a little bit. And so the bail has now been set at $5 million. So not likely that he will ever see the light of day again. But why did that happen? Then January 13, 2022, just a short time ago, Brianna Kufer, a UCLA student, was stabbed to death while working in a furniture store. She happened to be alone at the time. Sean Laval Smith was arrested. He had 11 felonies in arrest in South Carolina, including a 2019 arrest for discharging a weapon into a car. He was out on a $1,000 bail, which they classified as a misdemeanor, when he stabbed this young woman multiple times and, of course, killed her. Now, why is this a problem? I talked a little, I think, in a previous sermon about bail problems, but in the 2020 study of the variations in bail settings, and there's quite a few variations, this group really decided, let's really take a look at the situation. So they looked at about three-quarters of a million bail decisions over multiple states for all kinds of crimes, about three-quarter million bail decisions. Of those, about roughly three-quarter of a million, roughly a half a million were released on bail, which is about 74% of the total that were arrested. Now, of that original three-quarters of a million, about 13,000, a little less than 14,000, failed to report, which is about 15% of the three-quarters of a million that were arrested, and a little less than 200,000, or about 26% of those that were either bailed or not, were rearrested. So it doesn't seem that the system is working too well if about 26% of all those that were even considered for bail are rearrested before their trial. Now, This is what we refer to as noise. There's a lot of noise in bail setting decisions because for the same exact crime, bail may be set at $1,000, it may be set at $200,000. There's a lot of variation among judges, among municipalities, and this is often referred to as noise in a system. When you have this unwanted variability in judgments that should be identical. In which you have two people committed the same crime, they should be receiving the same bail. But that's not the case. So here we are going to be our third sermon, and the title of this one is Can You Hear the Noise? Now I want to talk about what we mean by noise when we're talking about this kind of variation. We use noise in a lot of things. Sports, you know, the noise. Make a lot of noise and maybe the guy will miss the foul shot. That sort of thing. But what we're talking about here is something different. It's really kind of a statistical thing more than anything else. So let's talk a little bit about statistics. Now, this is what we call a normal distribution curve, and it's a bar graph. And a lot of things tend to statistically form this general type of curve, this normal distribution curve. So I want to use an example of this bar graph. The line is just kind of connecting the dots, you might say. But suppose that, say, 1,000 meteorologists were asked to predict the temperature in New Orleans next Sabbath. Those 1,000 were asked, meteorologists, people who should know, what will be the maximum temperature in New Orleans next Sabbath? Now, if you did that, you would likely get a bar graph that looks something like this. And let's say that it turns out that the maximum temperature next Sabbath in New Orleans was 70 degrees. That was the high. More than likely, more than any other number, the meteorologist would probably, there'd be more that hit 70 than any other. You know, so this would be the group of, I don't know, say 600 might have predicted accurately it was 70. But then there would be a sizable group that missed it by a degree. Maybe some said 69, some said 71. And that would tend to be, in most cases, a smaller number. And then there might be even a smaller number that missed it by 2 degrees, 68 or 72. And even a smaller number that hit 73. Or 67, and then so forth. And that'd be a pretty small number that maybe got way down here somewhere and missed it by 10 degrees one way or the other. Not many would have done that. And so this is what we call a normal distribution. Why the spread? Why the spread? They're all meteorologists, and basically they're getting the same satellite information, the same weather information, the same... temperature readings of all over the place, the winds from all over the country and out in the Gulf, out in the oceans. They're getting this tremendous amount of data that's coming in. So they all got the same data, basically, from NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, is where practically all meteorologists get the data that they work with. And yet there's this variation. Why is that? Well, we're talking a little bit about statistics here. Just because you knew where every molecule in the air is today, it doesn't mean that you're going to know where they are a week from now. A lot of things could happen. There's a front moving. Maybe it doesn't get here. And it's a little slow in coming into the area. Or maybe there's more clouds than they predicted and the temperature didn't get quite as high as it would otherwise, or vice versa. So this is kind of a statistical thing. And so noise tends to reflect this statistical variation, which in many things is almost always there. And it can affect our decisions. Now, here I'll show you three different normal distribution curves, or actually four. This red one here looks kind of in proportion to this one I showed on the left. Not, you know, kind of proportionally, it looks about the same. This blue one, it's still a normal distribution curve, but it's squeezed in. In other words, there's not as many errors if the distribution looked like this. You know, now maybe if you asked, well, what's going to be the maximum temperature in New Orleans tomorrow? You might get something closer to this because there'd probably be a lot more that are accurate or within a degree of the accurate temperature. But then if you ask the same meteorologists, what will be the temperature 6 months from now? What will be the maximum temperature in New Orleans 6 months from today? The curve would probably look more like this. There would be a lot of scatter in there. So it'd be kind of flat and spread out. So the idea is we'd like to reduce the noise in things so that we can have more accuracy. And then there's this one over here. This is a normal distribution curve. Does that show up? It's kind of hard to see there. But this is also a normal distribution curve, but the whole thing's shifted over. Now, that's bias. Now, bias might happen because of all the meteorologists thought that hurricane was going to stay out in the Gulf, and suddenly it moves in. And then that changes everything. And so everything shifts in one direction or the other. And but that's the bias of the forecasters thinking, hey, I know hurricanes, and that one's going to stay out there. So you got that kind of thing can shift everything. So biases can play a role, but still there's noise. There's a scatter of things. And this exists in decision-making. Now I'm going to show you another graph here. This graph appears in the Baton Rouge newspaper every day. The top one shows the number of deaths. This is a bar graph. You have to look carefully, but this is a little, see, these are little bars, one for each day over the last couple of years. And this is the number of deaths, and this is the number of cases reported per day for the state of Louisiana. Now, the interesting thing about this is that there's a lot of noise because you see these bars, some are high, some are low. You can't see the low ones quite as well. You know, some of them are so low that they're almost non-existent. They're so low. But by the way, this graph was just a few days ago on an interesting number day. 2/22/22 was the day that this was taken. And there were 43 deaths recorded that day. But what they do, there's so much fluctuation here that to smooth it out so they can kind of get a pattern, they take what's called a seven-day average. So each day, they average the current day and the previous 6 days and plot that point. Then the next day, one drops off, another adds on, and it's an average of 7 days each time. And that's what's producing this curve. And you see there's the initial spike when the virus hit. It looks pretty close to a normal distribution. Then we had another spike that was less deadly, and then another one that was getting on up there, but kind of spread out more than the others. And then we had the Delta, and then we had the Omicron. And I looked at the paper this morning, and the plot this morning showed the number of deaths in the 20s. So it's been continuing to drop. So if things go like these others, it's going to continue to get down to relatively low number of deaths. But see, this is a normal distribution. Well, why? Well, there's lots of reasons. Now, it's a virus, and it you know, some people get sick and some don't. So some die and some don't. And it's kind of a random scatter. And that represents noise. And there's other things. Sometimes these reporting agencies from around the state will miss a day and they'll report them all the next day and things of that nature. And so all that reflects noise. And it's the same general pattern for the number of cases, but there's something quite different in this group. This small number of cases and each of these spikes, larger number of cases. And, of course, you see there's some variation from day to day and that sort of thing. But what's going on here? Well, this is one that's more explainable in the sense that practically very few tests were available back at this time. And then as time went on, more and more tests were available and more people were getting tested. And so the number of tests spiked up considerably, like in the Omicron. But the deaths didn't spike up that much in comparison. You know, it was much different from all these, you know, peaked somewhere just a little above or below, a little below 50 deaths a day. And, you know, so, but you can see how this normal distribution curve occurs in so many different things. And it's a statistical thing. Now, I want to go back to the study on bails here, the bail sitting setting. In 2020, they did a study, as part of the other study, but here's what they said. Can we improve the way we set bails? That was the ultimate goal of this whole bail study. And so they said, well, we're going to develop a model, a computer model. Some would call it artificial intelligence. Let the computer make the decision. Can we develop a good model that would do a better job of making the decision than these judges? Well, they worked on that, and what they did is they considered four things: the current offense, the rap sheet, how many previous crimes that they committed, prior failures to appear, that would seem to be pretty important, and age. You might not think that age is particularly important, but when they were looking at the data, what they saw was that the older you get, the smarter you seem to get, and not as many people would commit crimes on bail when they're older than the younger. There was a pattern there. So they were looking at all these patterns, and these seemed to be the main variables that they were looking at. And so they developed the computer model to predict flight risk, and they did it an interesting way. They said, we're not going to predict the flight risk as a single number per se. We're going to put it on a scale, say like 0 to 100. And the community, the district, the whatever, municipality, then they could set where they want to draw the line as bail or not bail, maybe at 20%, maybe at 30%, if you met the criteria, those that were less than 30% likely to commit another crime, not show up, draw the line somewhere. But what they want to do is see if they could get a good model to predict it. So here's what they did. You know, so they say, well, we won't say what's the acceptable risk, but if you don't let anybody out on bail, there's no risk. And if you let everybody back out on bail, there's not 100% risk. They're not all going to commit crimes. They're not all going to show up before for their trial and so forth. So there's some level there, you might say, you know, maybe 30%, maybe 40% risk if you didn't set bail at all. But anyway, they looked at a couple things with this model. And one is, they said, if the risk level is set at the number actually released, and they actually released 560,000 in round numbers in the data they were looking at, said, okay, suppose we set the risk level at the number that were actually released. But let the computer, considering these four things, select that 560,000 that are to be released. And when they did that, their conclusion was that you could have reduced crime by up to 24%, mainly because people behind bars who are released are most likely to commit further crimes when they're let out. And so they believe that you could have really released the same number if you did a better job of picking them, you'd have less crime and less people not showing up for bail or breaking the bail, not showing up for court. And then they said, well, if the risk threshold is set to reduce the number of people denied bail as much as possible without increasing crime. Now, they had from the data what the crime rate was from people that were released on bail. Says, okay, let's use that. We don't want the crime to increase, and they know what the percentage was, so let's set the line there. And when they did that, they turned that you could be reducing the crime by up to 42%. Now, I'm showing you this not to get into a big discussion of bails, but I'm showing you that there's a lot of variability in bail setting, and a lot of it is simply statistical, and that they could be doing a better job if they were using those statistics. And so there's a lot of noise in bail setting, is the bottom line. Why aren't these models used more? They don't use these models hardly at all. Why? One word we talked about last time, arrogance. A lot of arrogance of those who set the bails, the judges. They think they know better than anybody else or any computer or anything, any artificial intelligence or anything like that. There's a lot of arrogance in the system. Now, let's talk about sentencing a minute. Now, I talked about a little bit about this in a previous sermon. This was a 1981 study of judges and how the sentences varied. A lot of noise there, too. And they did an interesting study. They took 208 federal judges. And they gave each of these judges 16 hypothetical cases. You know, basically, the trial transcript, you might say, of 16 hypothetical cases for various levels of crimes. And asked them to give the sentence. So what was the results? Well, in only three of the 16 cases was there even a unanimous decision that they should go to prison at all. In other words, they couldn't even agree that this, in three of the 16 cases, they couldn't all agree that the person even go to prison. A lot of noise in the system. And then in terms of the variation in the recommended length of prison terms, in a fraud case, the average was 8.5 years. The longest was life in prison. So here's the thing. If you get caught up and convicted of a crime, you better hope and pray you don't have certain judges, because some judges are going to give the life sentence. Some judges are going to give you less than, that's 8.5 was the average. Which means some judges are going to give you a couple of years, some judges are going to give you life. That's scary when you think about it. We have that much variation. That's noise in the system. In a case where the average sentence was 1.1 years, that was the average of these 208 federal judges in one of the cases, average 1.1 years. The longest was 15 years. And if you plotted this out, you're going to see that normal distribution curve in terms of the sentences that judges issue. Now, I mentioned before that these were passed by Congress as guidelines, sentencing guidelines, but the Supreme Court struck it down in 2005 because of some technical issues not related to the data that we're looking at here. But they struck it down, and so what's happened since 2005? both bias, and some of this could be bias, but most of it is noise, increased significantly. You know, so that's where we are. They still use it as a guideline, but it's not required. You don't have to follow the guidelines, but they're there for your use. And so we kind of went back in reverse. Now, there are a couple things I want to talk about here in terms of noise. I'm going to spend some time explaining noise before I get into what it has to do with us. But I'll get there. But one thing is the illusion of agreement. There's a couple things here. One is a lot of people think the other people view the world the same way you do. Well, yeah, you know, we know that we don't view the world the same way they do, right? This people in this room view the world a little different from everybody outside this room. You know, I think most of us would agree with that. But does everybody in this room agree with each other on the worldview? I would say no. I'd say if you started picking some things and polling some things, you'd find that, yeah, there's some disagreements among us about things related to life, this world, this church, even. We might not all agree. I doubt if we do agree on every single thing this church teaches. Now, if we in the church don't agree completely on everything, you know, that's noise, and there's a lot more noise out there that we have to deal with. Now, here's an example of what I mean by the illusion of agreement. We tend to think we all agree. And they did a study of Harvard admissions. They have a committee of about a half a dozen or so that decide on which students to admit to Harvard. So each student has a file. They take the individual file. They give it to the first member of the committee. He evaluates it and gives a score, like 1 to 5, 5 being absolutely admitted, 1 being kick this guy out of here before he gets in near Harvard. All right? So they rate him. But see, here's the thing. The first rater takes that folder, puts his rating on the front, goes to the next one. Now, the next one knows what the first one rated. And so he gives his rating, passes it on, down through the... And so Harvard had asked this team to come in and study this, because what they were finding is a lot of people weren't succeeding. The ones they accepted, they would expect, hey, the ones that were highly rated, yeah, that should be a lot to get through Harvard. They weren't a lot. There were a lot of them that were failing, dropping out, and so forth, and they wanted to see how they could do a better job of admitting so there wouldn't be so many failures. And so they wouldn't miss any of the ones that they rejected that might really be good. And so the committee looked at what they were doing and said, well, what you're doing, the problem is that you need to mask the ratings so that each rater does not know the other's ratings until everybody has rated each candidate. And then you can sit down and discuss it. And if one rates it a 5, one rates it a 2, you can discuss the reasons why and come to a better decision on whether to admit the student or not. And I experienced the same thing, because in the structural engineering program, the admission to the graduate program in structural engineering did the same thing. Rated, passed it to the next person, the structures faculty, and it went around. And there was a lot of agreement. Now, when they told Harvard that here's the problem, they said, yeah, we tried that, but there was too much disagreement. Because, you know, there's a lot of variability in life and in people and things, and this is all noise. And we have noise. You know, I'm giving a sermon. Is there any noise in this sermon? Probably. But that's why we tell you, don't believe me. Believe the Bible. Believe God's word. I tell you that. Sandlands tells you that. Franks tells you that. Herbert Dr. Armstrong told you that back in the old days. That's where the truth lies. We just try to be as consistent as we can and not get too noisy. Now, what about speculation? That is noisy. That is really noisy. I think I've told this before, but I think it was after the 68 election. Nixon was elected. The Sabbath after the election, pastor of the church, and it was a long way from here where I was at that time, but the pastor of our church there stood up and said, "Well, we've had our last presidential election." And he said it just like that. He didn't say, "This could be our last presidential election." Because it's 68. Christ is going to come in 72. Said by 75, we'll be in the kingdom. So, you see the... That's noisy speculation. Anytime we talk about a prophecy, and we heard some discussion today about what does this pertain to Ukraine and so forth, and anytime we say, well, what this means is that within 5 years the beast is going to rise in Germany. He didn't say that, but. We get caught up in that kind of thing. We get caught up in the speculation. That's very noisy. And now I've been using examples of where multiple decisions are made. Things like sentencing, sentences, and from convicted criminals and so forth. You can kind of look at the averages, but what about singular decisions? And that's really what I'm focused on. I've been focused on in the last two sermons, is this idea of the singular decisions. Are they noisy? If I decide I'm going to pick up, move to another state, take a new job. Okay, how do I know that my decision is the best? Or is it because could there be noise affecting that? Of course it could be. I could be considering all kinds of stuff that I shouldn't be considering, and that would be the noise. And so, we can't measure it, but it's there because we see it in everything we can measure. So we're noisy in our own personal decision making. You have to ask yourself some questions like, would you make the same decision if some irrelevant factors were considered? And a lot of times we make a decision, we consider irrelevant factors, for example. A singular decision, you might look at it this way, as the first of repetitive decisions. Okay, maybe only one, you may only make it one time in your life. But if it's the first, you could look at it from the first repetitive decision, it could be noisy. You don't know, and we're going to get into that a little bit later. But the methods for reducing both bias and noise should work for both cases. And that's the point I'm making here. Now, the sources of noise. One source of noise is mood. And there are many studies that will show the effect of mood on decisions. And the way they usually do this, they take a study group of 50 or 100 or whatever people, and they'll divide it randomly in half, and they'll say, take a short video of something that makes you in a good mood, something that makes you laugh, something makes you happy, something like that. The other two, they'll give a really sad video and get you in a sad mood. And then they'll ask you to make a, how would you decide something? You know, they'll ask you, and there'll be differences just because of the mood. You know, so if you're making a big decision, you know, and you've probably done this. Have you ever been a case where you decided, okay, this is what I'm going to do, and you sleep on it? You get no more information, no more input. You got exactly the same thing as you had when you said, today, this is what I'm going to do. The next day, you change your mind. That's, see, things can be kind of noisy. If you'd acted the first day, you were wrong on the second day. If you acted on the second day, you were wrong on the first day. You know, see, that sort of thing. That's where the noise can come in, even if it's a singular decision. We tend to do that. You know, good moods, for example, make us more likely to accept the first impressions we have in a decision we might be making. Now, this one I like. They had an essay. Again, they divided into two groups. One group, they both had got the same essay to evaluate, but in one group, it was attributed to a very distinguished-looking, middle-aged man, you know, a professor, And the other group got the same essay, but it was a young woman that was the authorship was attributed to. And they asked, well, you know, how do you rate this essay? Do you agree with it? And, of course, they rated it differently just because they thought the author was either a young woman or a distinguished-looking professorial type. You know, that's noise. Test shows also moods affect gullibility. And I kind of like this one. What they decided to do is just take some nice-sounding words, you know, smart-sounding words, intellectually-sounding words, and just randomly put them together so that it, with the proper tenses and subject and verb and object and so forth, but they were nonsense. And here's one. And they would ask each group whether you agreed with this or not. Okay, here's one that they did I thought was interesting. Wholeness quiets infinite phenomena. How many of you agree with that? Wholeness quiets infinite phenomena. Well, when they asked people if they agreed with this, quite a few said yes. But they were just putting, you know, and that sounds, yeah, it sounds kind of philosophical, doesn't it? And they were just trying to put words that kind of sound how my mother used to call it highfalutin. People said, yeah, I agree with that. That makes sense. There's a lot, like I said, there's a lot of noise. And then, of course, there's the runaway trolley situation where you can save five people, but you have to throw a switch and that trolley's going to kill one person. And most studies will show maybe 1 in 10 will say yes, they would do that, because people just can't bring themselves to making the decision to kill anybody. But when a good mood is introduced, that percentage jumps out to about 3 in 10 that would, yeah, I'll go ahead and do that. So there are a lot of things that affect us, and a lot of it is just noise. Now let's look at some more from the scientific perspective, which is what I've been giving you so far, but also let's bring God into the picture. Another source of noise, gambler's fallacy. Now, here the idea is you get on hot streaks, and that streak's going to keep going, or, man, I'm on a losing streak, so I know I'm going to hit on the next one, that kind of thing. What they did is they looked at asylum judges, you know, who are proving giving people coming into this country illegally asylum. And when they found them, when the judges approved two consecutive cases, they were 20% less likely to approve the third case. And in other words, hey, I'm approving too many here. I got to back off. That's, you know, probably not a conscious thing, but it's kind of like a subconscious thing. That's noise. And I bet you're wondering if I was going to get around to a scripture or not. but look at 1 Corinthians 10, verses 11 and 12. Now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the age have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stand take heed lest he fall. There's a lot in this scripture, but one thing I see in this scripture is God saying there's a lot of noise out there, and a lot of bias out there. You really have to be careful, or you'll get sucked into it. And then another source of noise is simply stress and fatigue. Now, I doubt y'all all look pretty happy. I doubt that any of y'all are ever stressed or tired or anything. But a few of us do get tired, get stressed out from occasionally. And that can be a source of noise. And there was a study of 700,000 physicians, and it revealed that they're significantly more likely to prescribe opioids at the end of a day. Obviously, by the time they get to the end of the day, all they've been doing is seeing sick people all day long. They get tired, they get stressed, and they're much more likely to prescribe opioids at the end of the day than they would in the early part of the day. You know, so that affects your judgment. Look at Luke 21, verse 34. But take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighted down with carousing, drunkenness, and cares of this life, and that the day comes on you unexpectedly. Now, you know, carousing, drunkenness, but cares of life, just things that can get you down, that day can come on you unexpectedly. Now, I'm 80 years old. It's probably not going to come on me unexpectedly, because I'm probably going to be dead by then. But some of you are youngsters, you know. You're young. You're only 30 or whatever. It could come on you. So I can just relax. I can kick back because I don't have to worry about this. But here's the thing. When does that day come upon each of us? You know, when you think about it, when Christ returns, is returning, where will you be? Well, if you're alive, you may be rising to meet Christ in a new spiritual body. But also, if you're alive, you may not be arising. You may be just standing there. Look, what happened? Yeah. You could be left. I'm talking about this left behind stuff, but you know, you could be one of those that, whatever the reasons, God knows, you weren't there in the first resurrection. Or you could be rising from the dead with a new spiritual body. And the thing about being dead, the Bible makes clear that once you die, time stops. You know nothing. And so the day you die is basically in your time frame, the day that Christ returns. Because that's the next thing you're going to experience, or not experience, is rising from the dead. Or time is still standing still and you're dead and buried. But when that day comes, for each of our individual time frames, basically, is no later than the last day of our lives. You know? So it's something to think about from that perspective. Now, basically, you look at a lot of scientific stuff that talks about biases and noise and stuff like that. They look at three things: skill, wisdom, and motivation. They say the way that you can deal with this is you need certain skills, you need some wisdom, and you need motivation. And God doesn't disagree with that, but he looks at it a little bit differently. He believes that we need skills. We need to be trained in the skills of life. But in terms of wisdom, there's two types of wisdom: worldly wisdom and godly wisdom. We need both. As I said in an earlier sermon, God expects us to use worldly wisdom in the right way, but we need both. And then our motivation, what's the motivation of most of the world when it comes down to it? I'd say greed. You know, make lots of money, have lots of things, that sort of thing. But our motivation, faith, hope, and love. That's where our motivation comes from. So that's quite a bit different. So getting to the point, you know, most things, there's a lot of noise in everything. And our decisions in particular can be very noisy. So it'd be easy to make a weak decision, a bad decision, a poor decision, as well as a good decision or a great decision in different things. But what our goal is to take this noise variability and squeeze it down. Squeeze it on down so it looks like that. So it's squashed down. We want to get the noise out of the system as far as our decision making is concerned. Now, one type of noise is occasion noise. Noise that occurs in a specific occasion. And I want to concentrate, and I'm going to wrap this sermon up here in a couple of minutes. But concentrate on one example of occasion noise, and has to do with the princes of Judah. Princes of Judah. Now, I'm going to put a map up here just to give you a little idea of what we're talking about. In 597, Nebuchadnezzar conquered Judah, but did not conquer Jerusalem. He didn't seize, didn't destroy Jerusalem, but he pretty much conquered the surrounding area. And they made a peace, kind of a peace deal with Nebuchadnezzar, where Nebuchadnezzar made Zedekiah kind of a puppet king of Judah. All right. Then, and that was in 597 B.C. In 589, about 8 years later, Zedekiah formed an alliance with Egypt and wanted to break the yoke of the Babylonians. But Nebuchadnezzar got wind of it. In 588, Nebuchadnezzar invaded Judah and seized Jerusalem. Okay, so they're seizing Jerusalem now. This was when Jeremiah was thrown into the deep, muddy pit, and probably would have died there if he hadn't been saved by the servant of Zedekiah. But this was time, and Jeremiah was prophesying, give up, surrender, you know, they're going to take it. He was given all these prophecies. They didn't listen about what was going to happen. And so in 587 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar is seizing Jerusalem, and the Egyptian army starts moving towards Israel because they had some agreement there. So the Egyptian army was going to come and kind of help out. But when Nebuchadnezzar heard of it, he stopped the siege temporarily and went after the Egyptian army and basically chased them back into Egypt. Okay, that was in 587. And then he goes back and continues the siege of Jerusalem. And in 586 B.C., Jerusalem collapses. Zedekiah tries to escape, but is caught, carried off to Babylon. But the Babylonians release Jeremiah. And the refugees went up here to this area, Mizpah. So they went up into this area, and most of the Jews in Jerusalem, most of those were carried away. But there are a lot of Jews in the surrounding areas that did two things. They weren't carried away because they were kind of few and so forth. And some went into other countries, surrounding areas, to be safe. But they started coalescing up here in this area after the collapse and the governor, Nebuchadnezzar made the governor of Judah, Gedaliah. There was a little mini civil war among the Jews, and the Jews killed Gedaliah. And now they were in big trouble, because that's who Nebuchadnezzar had appointed. And they had to decide what to do. Do we run or do we stay? That was the big question. Now, look at the noise they were experiencing. This was a special occasion, catastrophe. People in Ukraine are experiencing some of these same kind of things right now. But Judah and Israel and Jerusalem were basically destroyed. Jerusalem was destroyed, completely destroyed. The Jews that were left were fighting among themselves. Food was scarce. The king's daughters were in the care of this small group of Jews. Who knew what the Babylonians were going to do next? And so the question was, should we stay or go to Egypt? That's what the question was. There was a lot of noise at that time. Nothing was going right. Everything was threatening. Everything was scary. And so they said, well, let's ask Jeremiah. We'll ask him. Now, basically, they were the ones that convinced Zedekiah to throw Jeremiah in the mud pit. They wanted him out of there because all he did is prophesy bad things. All right. But all those bad things happened because they didn't do what Zedekiah said God wanted them to do. Change. So they ask him, say, what should we do? Where should we go? You know, that's the question that they ask. Look at Jeremiah 42:19. It took about 10 days before Jeremiah answered them, but he said, the Lord has said concerning you, O remnant of Judah, do not go to Egypt. Know certainly that I have admonished you this day. Don't go to Egypt. Now he goes on and explains, he basically tells them, look, God's willing to take this small group and we'll start over. We'll start over, we'll build things up again, just stay here. Well, they didn't. They didn't like that idea. And so 70 years later, he took another group and said, hey, let's start over. But this group didn't. They didn't like this idea. And this is speculation, but I think my speculation is that they couldn't imagine Jeremiah or God telling them to stay there after what had just happened. And so they ask, knowing what the answer was going to be. You know, there's a saying among lawyers, so you never ask a question you don't know the answer to. I suspect they thought they knew what the answer was going to be. So, let's just ask Jeremiah. We don't like him much, but we're stuck with him. Let's ask him to ask God, and then we can go to Egypt. Jeremiah said, no, God doesn't want you to go to Egypt. Whoa. Now, here's the Babylonian Empire. Get my pointer up here. Whoops, I lost my pointer. Here's the Babylonian Empire. You can see it was everywhere. Now, at the time this happened, they had not conquered Egypt. So the southern edge of the Babylonian Empire was down here south of Jerusalem somewhere. It only went this far. But that whole Fertile Crescent was now controlled by Babylon, at least down to the borders of Judah and Egypt. And so what they wanted to do is get out of town and go over here to this area here. Let me blow that up a little bit. Go to this area here to Tophanes. That's this point right here. And you probably
can't see these letters too
well, but if you remember our sermons talking about the Exodus, you'll recognize some of these names: Migdal, Tahpenes, Pithon, you know, all these Ramesses, all these. Where did the Jews want to go? Now, it's been almost 1,000 years since the Exodus, and they finally get to go back to Egypt. After almost 1,000 years, they're going back to where? The land of Goshen. The land of Goshen. They're going back there. They finally decided to go back. Now, what happened? Now, it happened when Jeremiah had stopped speaking to all the people, all the words of the Lord their God, from which the Lord their God had sent to them, all these words that Azariah, the son of Hoshaiah, Johanan, the son of Kareah, and all the proud men spoke. Notice that, the proud men, they were arrogant. And it's recognized here, saying to Jeremiah, "You speak falsely. The Lord our God," notice, "Lord our God, has not sent you to say, 'Do not go to Egypt and to dwell there.' But Baruch, the son of Neriah, has set you against us to deliver us into the hand of the Chaldeans, that they may put us to death or carry us away captive to Babylon." You know, that was their response. See, they had made up their mind, and all the noise said, "Go." The one thing that was true was the word of God. And they knew it was true, or should have known it was true, because they saw that everything Jeremiah prophesied up to that point had happened. That was the peak of the probability curve here. That was the peak. That was the truth. They were down here somewhere because of all the noise. Hey, we got to go to Egypt. Everybody knows that. You'd have to be an idiot to stay here and get killed or taken away by the Babylonians. But they didn't understand the truth. And they should have. They didn't have any excuse not to, because Jeremiah had proved himself a true prophet. Now, Jeremiah 43, verses 5 first. "But Johanan, the son of Kareah, and all the captains of the forces took all the remnant of Judah who had returned to dwell in the land of Egypt." So some of those that had escaped before everything happened had come back. So there was a decent-sized group then, you might say, from all the nations where they had been driven. In the verse 7, "So they went to the land of Egypt, for they did not obey the voice of the Lord, and they went as far as Tahpenes." You know, so then Jeremiah chapter 44, verses 12 and 13, God through Isaiah is saying what was going to happen. "And I will take the remnant of Judah who have set their faces to go to the land of Egypt to dwell there, and they shall all be consumed and fall in the land of Egypt. They shall be consumed by the sword, by famine. They shall die from the least to the greatest by the sword and by famine, and they shall be an oath, an astonishment, a curse, and a reproach. For I will punish those who dwell in the land of Egypt as I have punished Jerusalem by the sword, by famine, and by pestilence." You know, so there's the prediction. Did it happen? It did. 568, 20 years after the siege of Jerusalem, Nebuchadnezzar did just that. He invaded, conquered Egypt, and he destroyed them. Now, the point here is that noise is always there. The noise can lead you in deadly directions. You know, the Jews, when you think about it, the Jews had something we've never had. Those Jews had something we've never had. And that is a true prophet of God among their midst, prophesying the future, telling them what's going to happen, and telling them what they have to do to keep it from happening. In detail. not just general prophecies that Christ is going to return or something like that, but giving the details of prophecy. We haven't had that kind of prophet yet. Maybe God will provide that at some point, but we haven't had that yet. So they had something that we don't have, or didn't, do not have. They had the words of a living, proven prophet telling them the right decision. Wouldn't that be nice? Wouldn't you like it if Jeremiah was here and you could say, "Hey, Jer, I've got this problem and I don't know what to do. What do you think God would tell me to do?" That'd be pretty nice, wouldn't it? Proven prophet. You know you could trust him. That would be nice. But we have something that they didn't have. We have something that they did not have. That's just as good. But you'll have to wait till next time to hear what that is.